Okay. I couldn't help but put that on. Okay. We're into the parables of Yeshua. And this perhaps is one of the most important of the parables. As you notice up here on the whiteboard, I've entitled it The Good Samaritan. Now, I've got good in inverted commas because there's nothing in the parable that indicates he was good. He might have been bad, for all we know. Yeshua doesn't call him good, he just says he's a certain Samaritan. All right? So it's we human beings who make value judgments and say this person over here is good and this person over here is evil or whatever. You know, we're the ones that do that. We've all got human nature. And so, leave it up to your imagination why it's called good. But anyway, I have subtitled it, How Yeshua Began to Announce the Advent of the New Covenant. And some people might think, who are listening to this, may feel that this is a controversial particular type of lecture that I'm giving. But really, it's biblical. And we need to look at it as it really is. Take ourselves back into the first century, back into the Second Temple milieu, and say, right, what was Yeshua doing? What was he saying? How was his audience responding? Did they respond? Or were they so shocked they all fainted? Or whatever. And we need to start with the actual parable. So if you turn over to Luke chapter 10, verse 25. Behold, a certain theologian stood up tempting him. Now, as soon as you look at your Bibles in that particular section, you're going to see lawyer. You're going to see lawyer. A certain lawyer stood up tempting him. Well, it wasn't a temptation, number one. And number two, he wasn't a lawyer. And I think we need to get things right. The Greek is nomagos, and that means a student of the Torah, or somebody who is a theologian, someone who really understands where he's coming from. And he says, Teacher, having done what, shall I inherit life eternal? He said to him, What's written in the law? How do you read? But he answering said, You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, and with all your understanding, and your neighbor as yourself. And he said to him, You've answered right. This do, and you shall live. Now, you will have in your versions, but he, desirous of justifying himself, right? Do you have that?
Yeah.
Take it out. Number one, because it is not in most of the old manuscripts, and it is certainly a suture. In other words, it's the editor going, well, you know, this is why this fellow was asking the question. Well, that's not kosher. It should read, He said to him, You have answered right. This do and you shall live. But he said to Yeshua, Who is my neighbor? Yeshua replying said, A certain man descended from Jerusalem to Jericho, and fell into the hands of bandits, who also, having stripped him and inflicted wounds, went away, leaving him in a half-dead state. And a certain priest happened to go down that way, and seeing him, passed on the opposite side, and in like manner also a Levite, being at the spot, came and looked at him and passed on the opposite side. But a certain Samaritan, now as soon as he said that, everybody would have gone, All right, it's like saying a certain Palestinian or whoever, you know. A certain Samaritan journeying came to him and seeing him was moved with compassion and came up to him and bound up his wounds, pouring in oil and wine, and having put him on his own beast, took him to the inn and took care of him. And on the morrow as he left, taking out 2 denarii, he gave it to the innkeeper and said to him, You take care of him. Whatever you shall expend more, I will render to you on my return. Which now of these three seems to you to have been neighbor of him who fell into the hands of the bandits? And he responded, well, he that showed him mercy. And Yeshua said to him, go, you do the same. It's interesting. You do the same. Now, in our last lecture, I took pains to go over the historical background of the Samaritans as a race. Who were they? And so on and so forth. And this was important because I cannot stress more strongly that Yeshua used a despised Samaritan, a hated Samaritan, to be the hero of one of his parables. All right? And a parable, what is it? It's a story with a message. And he used the Samaritan in order to launch a message. And what was that message? The message was the Messiah had finally arrived. Now, you may not get all that yet in this parable, but you will by the end of the lecture. And he had arrived prophetically right on time. Right on time. So his listeners would have been acutely aware of what the Messiah was to accomplish when he manifested himself to the people of Israel. I want you to keep that point in mind. Because most churches, most teachers and all of that, they just miss that whole point. They miss the whole point that the Jews at the time were expecting the Messiah and they expected him to achieve certain things. All right? So with the parable of the Good Samaritan, or the certain Samaritan as perhaps it should be, Yeshua was announcing a new covenant. Now you might say, well, where's that? Well, you'll see in a minute. And his audience was well aware of it for the following reasons. Because in the parable, Yeshua abrogates, not the Torah, but he abrogates the Levitical purity code and the Deuteronomic code. All Judea awaited a Messiah, and he would bring with him a new covenant and a new Torah. This is important to realize. The Messiah, according to the rabbinic authorities, when he arrives, is going to introduce an entirely new Torah. Now, Paul said, the Torah is good. And you know what we heard in the parsha today? Certain things about the land and all of that. And there's nothing wrong with that. There is, as Amos pointed out, a lot wrong with slavery. All right? But the actual inclusions of the first Sinai covenant, well, the only Sinai covenant, the inclusions are by and large fine. Apart from the Levitical purity codes and the fact that a woman can't go to her husband's aid if he's being killed by crushing the genitals of the assailant. That's not allowed. And in fact, she can be taken out and killed. Things of this nature I find very difficult to accept as good. Dwarf throwing contests, I said before, I don't have a problem with dwarf throwing contests, but I do have a problem with dwarfs not allowed to go into the kingdom, temple of God. But it is a historical fact that the Jewish people of the Second Temple period knew that when Messiah came, he would apply entirely new principles to the existing Torah, and he would adjust the purity regulations where he wished. It is written in the Midrash Kohelet, the Torah which a man learns in this world. Now this is the Mosaic or Sinai Torah. The Torah which a man learns in this world is vanity in comparison of the Torah of the Messiah. And when Yeshua came, what did he do? He made the Torah honorable. That's interesting. Because there were too many defects in that original Sinai Torah. Too many defects. I can sit down, I can tell you them all. You might go, well, it was okay for that age. Well, yeah.
That's the point.
But that's exactly as the Robertson just said, that's the point. We're now living in the 21st century. And some of these issues, especially where women are concerned, and especially with employer and employee relations, the Torah leaves a lot to be desired. But having said that, Yeshua tells us until heaven and earth pass, not the smallest letter or stroke shall pass from the Torah until all is accomplished. He did say that. But we must always bear in mind that he who wrote the law in the first place, that's Yeshua, he who wrote the Torah can validate or invalidate it wherever he wants. And I come back to a second point in relation to this. Yeshua was not considered sinless because of what he did or didn't do. He was considered sinless by God because of who he was. And this comes across in the parable about the Samaritan. Because the Torah is not set in concrete. And the rabbis know that it is fluid. It has a fluidity about it. And can be adjusted to cater to society's evolved conditions. Ezra did this. Ezekiel did this. Jeremiah did this. Yeshua did this. They adjusted the Torah where it was felt necessary. I find this interesting because most rabbinic students today would overlook that fact. So do hard-line, right-wing fundamentalist Christians. The Torah is immutable, they say. Well, no, it's not. No, it's not. I can show you many areas where the prophets adjusted it to fit the conditions.
God adjusted it through the prophets.
Well, that's exactly right. It's his Torah.
As he's adjusted his entire kingdom of earth, all the changes that it's gone through over the millennia.
But having said that, including what you just said, having said all that, the rabbis have a theory. Now, it's only a theory. But you know what? I'm inclined to go along with this theory. But I want to make it clear it's a theory. They believe that the Torah, which at creation coexisted in the mind of God, all right, being composed of 600,000 letters, now I've got this up here on the whiteboard if you want to make a note of it, was at the creation in complete disarray. All those letters were all over the shop. When Adam sinned, God took those letters and composed or arranged the Torah into words. Now, I want you to really think about this theory, because I like it. If Adam had not sinned, all the letters would have been rearranged in a different form. So, in short, when sin is finally abolished, a new Torah will become available with all the 600,000 letters rearranging themselves into completely different words. And this will be the new Torah, which the religious Jews have anticipated now for 2,000 long years. Now, it's an interesting theory. And following it along, I think, well, that makes sense, because it then shows that the Torah is eternal. It's just a matter of how you rearrange the vowels and the consonants. Yes?
Where that sin abounds.
It grows much more abounds.
Yeah, it grows much more abounds. So that Torah is fluent.
Well, that's right. All the time. That's exactly right. Yeah. Well, we mustn't confuse grace with law. You've got to keep that aside. Because grace is the character of God.
Yeah, but it's sin.
But that's exactly right. Yeah. But the sin, exactly. The Yemenite Midrash tells us, in the future, the Holy One, blessed be He, will seat the Messiah in the supernal yeshiva, and they will call Him the Lord, just as they call the Creator. And the Messiah will sit in the yeshiva, and all those who walk on earth will come and sit before him to hear a new Torah and new commandments and the deep wisdom which he teaches Israel. Again, as I've got here on the whiteboard, the Holy One, may he be blessed, will sit and draw up a new Torah for Israel, which will be given to them by the Messiah. Now, what I want you to listen to today, what I want to get through to you today, is that the Jewish rabbis have a view of the Torah and the commandments which we, as Messianic believers and as Christians, have failed to grasp. But scattered throughout the rabbinic commentaries and other Jewish writings, we find rabbis thoughtfully considering that there would come one day an end eventually to the commandments which are included in the Torah. Now, this is not a Christian who's about to say, I'm about to quote, these are rabbis, rabbinic authorities. Quote, in the future, the commandments will be annulled. Quote, this is how it will be in the days of the Messiah. There will be no thou shalt and thou shalt not commandments. Quote, at the end, the Torah will be forgotten. You've only got to go to Raphael Patai's Messiah texts to find all these rabbinic statements. Joseph Klausner tells us that the natural interpretation of all of this, that's what I've just quoted you, is that in the days of the Messiah, the Torah and the commandments will lose their significance. You see, this is because God is saying, I'm going to make all things new. Not all the old things renewed, a different coat, a different pair of trousers. No, 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 no. Everything is going to be new. And there can be little doubt in my mind that the rabbinic religious authorities grasped full well the significance of their own rabbinic understanding. It's we who sin by reinterpreting what they have said. And they understood that certain things should not be put into the hands of the Gentiles, because the Gentiles would become, they'd run amok. And they would become lascivious, and they would become licentious, and everything would get out of hand, and the whole world would cave in to demonic depravity. And I believe that's correct. The consequences would be terrible indeed. Because human beings have human nature, and human nature of itself is devoid of the Spirit of God.
Yeah.
That's obvious.
Lust.
Yes, lust, that's right.
Inquisitions.
Well, yeah. Absolutely. Now, here is just one example. I'm going to give it. It's going to put everybody in a spin, but that's what I'm here for, because I need to always unsettle where you are. And because, you know, faith is that which you have to outwork. And this thing in here is called a brain. And I like people to use their brains. Now, here is a messianic psalm. Turn over to Psalm 146. Psalm 146 and point 7. Verse 7. 146, verse 7. I'm just going to give you this one example. I could give you many, but I just want to give you one example of rabbinic understanding of this matter. And again, I have no real trouble with it. And I'll tell you why in a minute. Okay. Talking about the Messiah and this psalm, the verses from 7 onwards are all fulfilled in Yeshua's ministry. They continue to be fulfilled today, and they will continue to be fulfilled tomorrow. All right? We read about the Messiah, who executes judgment for the oppressed, who gives food to the hungry. The Lord sets the prisoners free. Now, it's the phrase, the Lord sets the prisoners free, which gives rise to rabbinic speculation. In the Midrash Tehillim, we find this astonishing comment. Now listen to this carefully. The Lord sets the prisoners free. What does this setting free of prisoners mean? There are those authorities who say that in the future the Holy One will make all unclean animals fit for eating. Now, you may immediately go, whoa, what? No, this is a rabbinic comment. And I have personally, as the Robertson knows, had conversations with rabbis who all recognize that this is a valid interpretation of the psalm. because of its messianic setting. And especially is this the case when we look at certain scriptures in Isaiah about conditions for humanity in the kingdom of God, when the unclean will praise God, when the unclean animals will be worthy of God's acceptance, meaning that they would be all pronounced clean. But this interpretation, I believe, that is, that the Holy One will make all unclean animals fit for eating. And let's face it, biologically, the blood of the Messiah didn't clean a thing. It didn't clean animals, it cleaned us. It didn't change the biological function of a pig or a vulture or a snake or a rabbit. It didn't make them clean. The blood of Christ made us clean. But it may lend weight to the belief, which I hold, that medical science at the conclusion of the age will extract from unclean creatures specific chemicals, specific substances that can be utilized for the treatment of such ravaging diseases as cancer, rheumatic conditions, heart disease, and other illnesses. Warfarin is used for heart problems, and that's Ratzak. Hello. Yeah. Yeah. Certain muscles today can be used for arthritic and rheumatic conditions, healing them. The Maori have been eating certain of these unclean sea creatures for years, and they are, many of them who do eat that are free of certain diseases. So it makes you wonder whether or not this is what God is talking about. At the end of the age, so many chemicals will be able to be extracted from unclean creatures to be used in medicine. Could be. Sorry?
Emu oil.
Good example. All right. I mention that only because I want people to realize the Torah is fluid. If I go into a restaurant, I've said this before and I'll say it again, and I'm eating fried rice. I like Chinese food. Right? I love Chinese food. When I can afford it, I go to a restaurant, and that's the last time we went was about 5 years ago. Anyway, but the fact of the matter is that if I go there and I'm having fried rice and I'm eating something and there's a little bit of a prawn in there, I'm not going to suddenly go, oh my goodness, no, and race outside and vomit. I'm not going to do it. I'll eat it. If I really feel guilty about it, I'll take a herbal bowel pill in the night and the next morning it'll all be washed out anyway. The fact of the matter is I'm not going to get funny about it. That's what I'm saying. And the Torah isn't set in concrete anyway. And this applies not merely to the 613 commandments of the law, but to the bedrock of the Sinai or Mosaic covenant, which consists of the Ten Commandments. The Sinai covenant was a marriage contract, and the bedrock of that marriage contract, the foundational bedrock on which the covenant was formed, was the Ten Commandments. Now, the Ten Commandments were deficient. They needed 613 other commandments to explain the Ten. And then they had to have prophetic, the prophets and the writings to explain how the 613 could be utilized or applied, whether in the bedroom or wherever it might be. They needed all of that. So the Ten Commandments, of course, had all kinds of difficulties, and I've given lecture after lecture after lecture on the deficiency of the law. So this is nothing new to anybody. But they remain in the New Covenant as a bedrock. The Ten Commandments, not the 613, but the Ten Commandments, remain as a foundational bedrock for the New Covenant. But please notice on the whiteboard, the blood of Messiah is the bedrock of the New Covenant. The Ten Commandments are a bedrock, an adjunct to the New Covenant, but in an adjusted form from that which was given at Sinai. Are you following me? I hope you are. But again, even in the days of Ezra, you will find that the Ten Commandments were adjusted here and there, and if all you've got to do is get Exodus chapter 20 and then compare that list with Deuteronomy chapter 5, and you will see remarkable differences. And again, the prophet Ezekiel. God changed the law in his day, and that's an absolute fact. The Ten Commandments, remember, though, were in force long before Moses, long before Sinai. You open Genesis, which is the first book of the Torah, and you will find the Ten Commandments in one form or another mentioned. And the same Ten Commandments are scattered throughout the writings of the New Testament. You'll find them all the way through. And, of course, the Ten Commandments as a foundational bedrock of the New Covenant are the Ten Commandments. They are not the Ten Good Suggestions. They are God's commandments. So now we come, with that little bit of introduction, we now come to the actual parable of the Good Samaritan. Now, again, I've said earlier that the Good Samaritan is not mentioned as a Good Samaritan. He's a certain Samaritan. I want to make that really clear. But the truth of the matter is, we all have human nature. We all have human nature. And some people are more prone to friendliness than other people. that's a fact. And we find that this particular Samaritan was compassionate toward all people. All people. And not merely his own race. And there are compassionate people scattered all around the world. And this becomes evident when there's a crisis or some shocking natural disaster or human disaster. People come to the rescue, they come out of the woodwork, they hop over fences, they'll do whatever they can. They'll hold parties to raise money for tsunami victims. People are compassionate for those who are in crisis, particularly if those crisis situations are involving those where you know. All right? And to use a Samaritan, to use a Samaritan as a hero of this parable is Yeshua defying the Jewish nation, expecting them to reconsider his axiom that we ought to love even our enemies. To what extent should we love even our enemies? Yeshua said, a new commandment I'm giving you, that you should love one another as I have loved you. I often hear people say, yes, a new commandment, we should love one another.
As I have loved you.
And? Yes. What do you mean and? What's the rest of it? As I have loved you. And you know what? To what extent did Yeshua love us? Well, you've only got to think of what he did. What he did. I'm not just talking about the cross event. I'm talking about the fact that he resisted sin for his entire life. He lived a righteous life, acceptable to God the Father, for no other reason than to apply his life to us. So when we screw up, when we fall on our face, when we do the wrong thing, when we say the wrong thing, when we think the wrong thing, don't worry, you're not going to go to hell for it. He's already been there and he's applied it to us. His life is applied to us. His death is applied to us. His resurrection has been applied to us. That gives me, a fool of all people, a sense of security. Awesome security. He says we should love even our enemies. Turn over to Luke chapter 9, because, you know, the disciples lived and breathed with Yeshua for a number of years. He knew them long before his ministry. That's a fact. But on one occasion, he and his disciples are passing through a Samaritan village, traveling to Jerusalem in order to observe a Jewish festival. Where am I, Luke? And Yeshua seeks a hospitable place to stay for the night. Luke chapter 9, verse 52. Yeah, he sent messengers before his face, and they went and entered into a village of the Samaritans to make ready for him. But they did not receive him. Why? Because his face, or his intention, was that he was going to Jerusalem. Yeah, they didn't want Yeshua, the Jew, going to Jerusalem. They wanted him to go to Gerizim. All right? When his disciples, James and John, the sons of thunder, when they saw this, they said, Lord, call fire down from heaven and burn these Samaritans alive. Don't muck around, Lord. Wipe them out. Turn them into fertilizer. All right? Get rid of these bums. Incredible. Even in Arab cultures.
Well-meaning fellows.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, you knew where they stood. Everybody knew where they stood. But in Arab cultures, even today, hospitality must be shown to even one's enemies. If they turn up at night and knock on the door and want a place to live, sleep, they've got to show hospitality. They've got to eat and they've got to not eat you. Well, they might in the morning. They've got to give you food and drink and bed and all of that. As I said, they may kill you in the morning, but they've got to be hospitable the night before. And in this instance, Samaritan hatred rises up, and Yeshua and his disciples are summarily rejected. And they say, you know, get rid of them. And that brings a severe rebuke from the Lord. But please note, these are Samaritans. It just shows the hostility that existed way back there in the Second Temple period. But Yeshua in this parable stresses the principle that a neighbor, as in love your neighbor as yourself, is anyone who is in dire need of help. Anyone who is in need of assistance. And Yeshua in this parable is broadening the whole Jewish view that a neighbor is one who is a colleague, a co-worker, the next door a family, or a companion, a close friend. And it is rather interesting when the Orthodox theologian says, you know, who is my neighbor? Yeshua turns around and he talks about the law and he says, what is written in the law? How do you read? Now, this is not a hostile reaction by Yeshua. He's actually saying to this theologian, you've got a lot of potential. And he sums it all up. He says, and how do you read? And Yeshua points his listeners to the fact that this Samaritan is the neighbor. This would have been a revolting concept. They wouldn't have been laughing at Yeshua. They would have been hostile. Who is my neighbor? But Yeshua narrows his decision-making ability down, this theologian, he grants him multiple choice. look at what it says. Which of the three? You know, is it the priest? Is it the Levite? Or is it the Samaritan? You know, he gives it multiple choice. And according to Professor Brad Young in his book, The Parables, Jewish Tradition and Christian Interpretation, he says the opening comment of the story, he desiring to justify himself, is a connecting sentence that was not in Luke's source, but it was added as an editorial suture. The astonishing conclusion of the parable demonstrates the Torah scholar was sincere because he arrives at the proper answer after hearing the parable. You've got to, I've mentioned that again there, to underscore the fact that, you know, the translators of our Bibles have shown a terrible inclination to try and place motive into the heart of this man. Mm. I find this in newscasts, when I'm watching NBC or whatever, Fox or whatever I'm watching on the news, and you will find commentators now who never in the past were allowed to give personal opinions and judgments. They're there conditioning the person who's watching the news broadcast, they're conditioning them by their comments, you know, hey, did you realize that person is such an evil person? You know, oh yeah, I don't know how could he do that? And they're communicating to one another, the newscast people, and I'm sitting there going, you can't do that, you're not allowed to do that. But oh no, we turn a blind eye these days, especially if it's related to Jews and Palestinians. I might get onto that, really, you know, a guesstimate. All right. The where am I? Young goes further in his insistent hair splitting, though, between the expectations of the written Torah and the Pharisaic oral Torah, which he claims Yeshua supported, as much as his more correct delineation between the Pharisees and the Sadducees. He suggests in his book that the oral Torah expects compassion for your enemy. I'd like to know where he gets this, because I have gone through all the oral Torah and I don't find anywhere where it says you've got to have compassion for your enemy. In fact, if you ask a rabbi, if you write, Google it, just put in, you know, can you love your enemy? The answer is absolutely not. You hate your enemy. All right? That's the response. That's the rabbinic response. Hate your enemy. Well, Yeshua turned around and said, love your enemy. But because Christianity has had such an effect on the world, the rabbis can adjust their oral Torah any way they want to make it sound like they're in agreement with Yeshua and enunciated these principles before Yeshua did. And I find that a very, very sus practice. Very sus. Yeshua is opening the true heart of God to humankind. He is opening the heart of God and he uses a despised, hated Samaritan as the hero of his parable to do this. I find this incredibly brave of Yeshua to have done such a thing. To have done such a thing. And he was making an announcement that a new Torah and a new covenant was becoming available to all humanity, including the Samaritans. Now, Professor Young, again, I'm going to quote him, he says, all written laws of the Torah must be violated to preserve life. Now, that is quite true. That is quite true. But he fails to emphasize the fact that God's law required the priest and the Levite to steer clear of a cadaver or anyone with an issue of blood. This was the requirement of the law. And of course, Young leaves that right out of the equation, or largely out of the equation. You've got to be careful. I mentioned the oral Torah. You've got to be careful about the claims of the oral Torah. Usually, it is the case that they contain the oral law contains traditions that predate the Second Temple period. And I readily acknowledge that. And I appreciate that. It's truly the case. But in the light of the Nazarene Gospel inclusions in what we call the New Testament canon, including the parable of the Good Samaritan, some Jewish traditions, and please, I've used traditions in inverted commas, may have arisen post-Second Temple period as a way of combating the ignorant Gentiles and Jews both in relation to the then, by then, popular teachings of Christianity. We've got to be very, very careful on this. Yes.
Although the claim is consistently made that the traditions have been held, were handed by Joshua to the elders and then the elders to the men of the great assembly or the second temple specifically, the majority of writings come from between the 1st and 3rd centuries CE.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's what we've got to
from
keep
Rabbi
that in mind.
All the way down, that's way after Messiah.
That's right.
It's like 170 years after.
That's not to negate the traditions which clearly antedate the Second Temple. But there's a lot of stuff in there that sounds very much like Yeshua's words.
The Essenes have traditions which go back to the First Temple times which aren't understood and are flatly rejected by Talmudic rabbis of that era. So you know,
Exactly. Okay, so hop over to Luke 17. Luke 17. Because I want to show you how Luke is perceiving the Samaritans in his gospel. If you turn over to Luke 17 and look at verse 11. Verse 11. It came to pass that as Yeshua was proceeding on his way to Jerusalem, he also himself was going through the midst of Samaria and the Galilee. And as he was entering a certain village, 10 lepers were passing by, who at a distance raise their voice upon recognition, saying, Master, Yeshua, you who have power and authority, please be sympathetic toward our affliction and do something to help us. Having seen them, he replied, having gone on your way now, show yourselves to the priests as proof of being cleansed. Now, you know, he hasn't done a thing. He says, okay, now on your way. That must have been in a bit of a spin, going, what? And it came to pass that as they left him on their way to the priests, see how obedient they were? They just thought, well, this is Yeshua, I better do what he says. They found themselves indeed cleansed. It's not until they're actually on their way to the priests, they go, hang on. Oh, my chest still has a nipple on there. They're left. I've got five fingers now. All right. Okay. And one of them, please notice this, one of them, seeing his change, returned shouting loudly with rejoicing toward God. Wouldn't you? Fell on his face, expressing his absolute gratitude to him. And he himself was a Samaritan. See that? Mm-hmm. Once again, it's the reject that comes back and thanks God. And not just thanks God, but shouts loudly and with rejoicing toward God. That's what it says. Falls on his face, expressing absolute gratitude. You know, Yeshua said to me, were there not 10 cleansed? Hello? Where are they? The 9, where are they? Now, if you've got, were they not found returning to give glory to God except this foreigner, take it out. Or, if you don't want to take it out, just put a little note, scribal editorial. Because this scribe is actually then who's reading this, and he gets incensed. Okay? And it's his comment, not Luke's. It's his comment. He says, were they not found returning to give glory to God except this foreigner? You know, he was so exasperated, he sticks it in the scripture. Anyway, so Yeshua says, the 9, where are they? And he said, having arisen, be going on your way, for your faith has restored your body to soundness of health. Your faith. Listen, the highest religious authorities at that time, in the Second Temple period, the highest authorities were the Levites and the priests. And in this story, Yeshua is sharing, both leaders of the Jewish people walked right around that poor Jew, their injured brother. And it doesn't say anything in the parable about what they were feeling. It says nothing about what their motive was or how they felt toward that fellow. We read a lot into that parable. We've got to remember they went out of their way because they were commanded by the Torah to do so under the terms and the conditions of the Sinai marriage contract. And this lawful expedient is not comprehended by most Christians, let alone Christian scholars. They were doing what was required of them. To come into contact with an injured fellow Israelite would have caused them to become ceremonially unclean for a period of 7 days, which would have been better served doing good for the majority of people under their care. So rather than be rendered unclean, restricting them in their religious vocation for doing good, they obey the commandment which says, stay away from anybody who looks dead or has an issue of blood. That's what it says. And you'll please make a mental note on paper, because I want to keep this under an hour. Numbers chapter 19, verses 11 to 16. That's Numbers 19, 11 to 16. And I want you to compare Leviticus 15. So that's in your private time. Have a good look at it. But they're the commandments for the priest and the Levite to not go anywhere near blood, otherwise they'll be unclean.
Yeah, and the dead.
Sorry?
And the dead.
Yep.
Someone with an issue, they can examine them, they can't touch them.
Yep. In this parable, Yeshua reveals to those with ears to hear that the showing of mercy and love toward humankind is a compelling higher law that needs to be considered. But Yeshua is also preempting the conditions and expectations of the new covenant prophesied by Jeremiah and the other prophets. This is most important to understand. He is not merely announcing its impending reality by making those commandments of no effect anymore. And remember, if you take away the bedrock of the commandment, you've abolished the covenant itself. Because they are one. You don't have the law over here and the covenant over here. They are one. And when Yeshua turns around and he abrogates certain Levitical purity laws, guess what that does to the covenant? Can't even do it. Okay? It fizzles out. Don't forget, the Sinai covenant was a contract with Israel, and God divorced Israel and thus annulled the covenant with Israel in 721, 718 BCE, when the Assyrians came in and violated her. But he was married to two women, both sisters. And unfortunately, you know, God didn't take his own advice. He says in the law, don't marry two sisters. You can't have two women in the kitchen who are blood. You can't do it. And he marries two sisters. Even Ezekiel scratched his head over that one. But then Judah was conquered by the Babylonians in 585, 586. And so the covenant, the marriage contract there, was also rescinded, torn up, torpedoed. So when the Jews came back into the land, they wanted to keep the Torah. They wanted to keep the Sinai covenant. For all intents and purposes, it was useless. It didn't exist anymore. They were waiting on a new covenant. This is why Jeremiah and Ezekiel talked about the new covenant in relation to on your return from captivity. They were to expect a new covenant, a new deal, a new marriage contract, but it didn't come until Yeshua did. Incredible. Incredible. Now, I've mentioned the Ten Commandments not being set in concrete. I just want you to have a look at something. This is, but I have said that the Ten Commandments are a bedrock of the New Covenant, but in a modified form. I want to show you what I mean. I want you to look over at Ephesians chapter 6, because I have read a book by a particular Messianic teacher who confuses a lot of issues, and he's trying to restate the New Covenant in terms of a renewed covenant. And this Messianic teacher says that even in Ephesians, you find the commandment, honour your father and mother. I want you to have a look at what he doesn't mention. I want you to have a look at Ephesians chapter 6. Verse 1 says, honour your father and mother, which is the first commandment with promise, that it may be well with you and you may dwell long on the earth. That's what it says. Paul's writing this and he's restating the commandment, the fifth commandment, all right? But please look at what is said immediately prior to his quotation of the fifth commandment. Children, obey your parents in the Lord. Then he says, for this is right, honor your father and mother, okay? Which is the first commandment with promise, that it may be well with you and you may dwell long on the earth. But he's qualified it. He's qualified the commandment. Obey your parents in the Lord. Now, this can be interpreted in any way of three ways. But whatever the case, no longer is blind honor required. No longer going out of your way to heap tons of affection on parents who are cruel and heartless. This adjustment, as I said, can be looked at in three ways. Number one, it says, obey your parents in the Lord. So the parents must be Christians too. That's one way of looking at it. That's one way of looking at it. Obey your parents in the Lord. In other words, obey your parents who are in the Lord. That's how it can be looked at. Or two, they must indeed be honoured if they qualify for mutual respect. You might say, well, how do you get that? Look at verse 4. Verse 4 says, you fathers, provoke not your children to extreme anger, but raise them in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. See that? It's all part of the fifth commandment. And then, point 3, they must be obeyed according to your personal knowledge or belief as to how you feel Yeshua would have acted toward his own parents, assuming they were people who loved their children, as Paul further elucidated in that verse 4. So you can look at that statement and rearrange that adjustment to suit whichever factor of the commandment you want to emphasize. And Sinai didn't allow for qualifications like this. Didn't allow for it. The commandment was straightforward with a carrot dangling in front of it as a promotion or encouragement for strict obedience. You know, honour your father and mother in order to get a long life in the land God's giving you. Okay? Paul restates it.
The dry bones of the Torah.
Dry bones of the Torah, you're not wrong. So why would Yeshua use the example of a despised Samaritan? Could it be the case that as people read the Torah about the Canaanites, that they simply transposed the term Samaritan on it? Because they looked upon the Samaritans as Canaanites, as nothing but God-rejecting people. Whatever the case, Yeshua extolled the actions of the Samaritan who went right out of his way to help one he saw as his neighbour. That is, a brutalized Jew. I look at, in my study, at the reverence, the reverential awe, the extreme fanatical devotion that the rabbis of the Second Temple period had toward the Torah. And I look at rabbis today with the same understanding that they had in the Second Temple period, where everything was law, 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 law. You know, if you see a rabbi, whatever you do, if you're a woman, don't go up and shake his hand. Okay, don't go up and go, oh, I really like you, hug. He'll faint, or worse still, he'll call down judgment and fire from heaven on you. All right? After all, if you're a woman, you may have your period. Hear me? This is why when they dance at a wedding, you've got a handkerchief between a rabbi and a woman.
Between any man and woman,
but especially a rabbi. If you're there, well, you know. The fact of the matter is, in my view, the veneration they have toward the four books of Moses, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, because Genesis is often just put aside because of its accommodation, doctrine of accommodation. But those four books, their veneration borders on the idolatrous. And in my view, and this is only my opinion, but in my view it almost comes close to Mariolatry in Roman Catholicism. It is total, complete, overwhelming veneration. Only eclipsed by the veneration they have for the Mishnah and the Talmud.
Yeah.
In fact, the Talmud takes advantage over the Torah, no matter if it's even a prophetic word that comes in the books of the prophets.
Will not use the word of the prophets to formulate the religious law.
No, they won't.
That's blasphemy.
Yeah. Heavy stuff. If one rabbi disagrees with 99 statements by the prophets, the rabbi's word is the one that's accepted. Mm. And that is frightening. Mm. It is frightening. All right. Here was a prime example of Yeshua teaching, in which he creates an entirely new theology, an entirely new morality, upon Hashem's authentic, sentimental, loving concern for humankind, rather than the expectation by God to simply put into operation and function the mere observance of rules and regulations. Which rules and regulations, I might just remind everybody, were brought into an existence by the authority of God, but through angelic powers. And surprise, 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 the Jews who were hearing this parable all knew that the Samaritans were religiously bound up now in the five books of Moses. They accepted the Torah. And yet, the Samaritans grasped in their Torah, which also talked about priests and Levites going around to someone with an issue of blood and or a cadaver, those same Samaritans grasped what the religious authorities amongst the Jews never, ever, ever conceived. And that was that God wanted a higher expectation of his people than what is written in a commandment.
Yeah.
In other words, it is possible for any of us to keep the commandments of God and violate what God wants. Yeah. How else can you understand the parable of the Good Samaritan?
Yeah.
A new theology was created by Yeshua. A new theology and a new morality. And I find this absolutely fascinating. Because the Levites and the priests were conditioned. They were conditioned to being obedient. You might go, well, that's good. No, it's not. If you lose the ability to feel for your fellow man. The Levites and the priests in this parable were working a respectful submission to the Torah's expectations of them. And the Samaritan, in remarkable contrast, saw deeper into the mind and heart of Israel's God and allowed compassion for an enemy to become the essential ideal to follow. This was revolutionary. We read the parable now and we go, oh yeah. But back in the Second Temple period, it would have been mind-boggling because Christ was taking the outlook of the people of the time and going, screwing it around like taking a jar off
lid.
Yeah, lid. Off, I was going to say jar off a lid. Well, that's quite possible too. You can do it. Depends how you look at it.
Might be upside down.
Might be. Samaritans, like the Canaanites of old days, hated and despised by the Jews of the Second Temple period, and the feeling was mutual, have in fact, through Yeshua, become the announcers, the heralds, of a new way of thinking. You know? And if we're not seeing that in this parable, we are of all men and women, most blind. Fact. In the final analysis, it is Yeshua who crosses from eternity to sinful planet Earth and finds us beaten up, spoiled, by our own life decisions, broken, bruised, bleeding, pitifully lost. And the domain of death has covered us, and only he can save. Yeshua's parable reveals that we can no longer claim to justify ourselves. We can no longer claim to work out our salvation apart from him. We can no longer follow Aish.com or other Talmudic, illicit, rabbinic sites as having a form of godliness in our self-salvation projects. And I get incensed by it because it is in there, it's coming along saying, you don't need a saviour. You can do it yourself. You've only got to do this and do this and think that. Anybody that believes that's a fool. We can no longer claim to be devout and as perfect as we would like others to think of us. If any of us persist in this folly, God will reveal it to us eventually, usually through trials, dramatic trials, and we will be more the fool. Without Yeshua, we are a broken people Without Yeshua, we are robbed of any hope. Yeshua does not avoid us like the Levite and the priest. He loves us unconditionally, with no strings attached. This was the weakness of the Sinai covenant. You shall love. It's interesting. Yeshua says, what's the greatest, one man asked him, what's the greatest commandment of all? And Yeshua says, you shall love the Lord your God. Yes. But they missed the point of what was going on in that interlude with that questioner. Because the commandment to love negates the ability to love. Think about it. Think about it. It is the weakness of Sinai. You cannot be commanded to love God. You can't. Love is that which cannot be commanded. It's part of free will. You know, you shall love me, you're my wife. Oh, hello. What a nonsense. What a nonsense. A love response is entirely a matter of our will. Love is a volition of will, not a feeling. The feeling comes later. It's like the icing on the cake. You've got to say something.
I was going to ask two questions, if you don't mind.
Sure.
The story of the Samaritan, judging by the fact that everybody he was speaking to was pretty respectful through it, even though it's a massive controversial thing that he's saying. Is it possible that that was a well-known
story?
Something act that had happened?
Well, yeah, he says it's a Samaritan. They knew him.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Do they realise... the story that everyone know it, because it kind of sounds like it might have been. He mentions things like the tower of falling.
People forget about the word certain. You can read it over and over and over in the Gospels, where Yeshua says a certain event or a certain person. That word certain indicates
people knew who
he was talking about. Yeah.
That's interesting. Mm. I wonder what the Samaritan's name was. I wonder who is he?
It wasn't Simon Magus. No. So.
He was only hungry for power.
Yeshua showed all of us. He showed all of us. He displayed all of us his loving concern in his freedom of will. Loving us so much that he gave his all. I was told years ago, do not deny the blood. And we were praying about this morning. That was given to me way back in the day in my Damascus Road. Do not deny the blood. And you sort of go, well, I would never deny the blood. But over the years, I've come to see the depth of that word. And there are so many people out there who are denying the blood in preference to... Now, thou shalt... Okay. I'm not knocking the thou shalt. I'm just... All the thou shalt nots. I'm just saying that there's another way of looking at things. And the shed blood of Messiah, his bleeding for us, his death for us, displaying an ideal of kenotic, self-sacrificial love, in that self-sacrifice, Yeshua announced in very colourful terms, the new covenant. And this is the message of the Good Samaritan. Yeshua strips from himself his Jewish identity. Think about it. He doesn't die as a Jew for humanity. He dies as the one new man for humanity. And he rises up the one new man for humanity. Humanity, not Israel. Humanity, not the Jews. Humanity, humanity, humanity. This is what it's all about. He casts himself in the image of the despised Samaritan. One who reaches out and saves, as the song says, a wretch like me. Was he a Jew? Of course he was a Jew. Did he die a Jew? Of course he died a Jew. Was he raised a Jew? No. He was uncircumcised when he was raised from the dead. Think about it. If he was raised from the dead as a circumcised Jew, he would be forever subject to Torah. But he is the living Torah. Think about it. Think about it seriously. Don't just reject it out of hand. Just contemplate on that. Like the good Samaritan who cleanses the dying Jew, takes him on his donkey to the inn, pays all the charges in advance. So Yeshua cleanses us and takes us to the Father, paying all the charges in advance for our continued perfect shalom and eternal well-being. Yeshua and Yeshua alone is the Good Samaritan. Any questions on that?
What you just mentioned about circumcised or uncircumcised, aside, when he is resurrected, this the scar, the wounds in his flesh, and even Thomas, you know, Judah Thomas, his brother, wanted to see those marks, you know, and touch the whole, touch his side. So, does that mean that he's subject to the wounds of the crucifixion, even though he's been raised from the dead? You know what I mean? Because that's an argument that, you know what I mean, that would also arise from that other one. And I'm just curious about that. In that case, you know, obviously we are subject to that, but also to the resurrection. But since he is raised from the dead, I mean, he's been given a new body, I'm sure, right now, that probably doesn't contain a human. Who knows? But
we don't know.
The angels, not, you know, we will become like the angels. Neither marrying or being given in marriage, okay? But we'll be bearing his image and sitting on the throne with him, so we're going to be as he is. So I don't know if that's exactly a...
No, it's not a good comparison.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I don't know. That I'm just questioning that the argument could also be made. Is he then subject to the marks of his crucifixion and torture? Do you understand what I'm saying?
I hear what you're saying.
Because like that cut, that flesh, you know, the circumcision means you're a subject, one to the covenant
of
Abraham.
Stop and think.
You know?
He's crucified. The Mount of Olives, they pick up flint because that's what's on the Mount of Olives, has been for 2,000 years.
Yeah.
When you are stoned to death, which is what Yeshua was subjected to, where do they aim? It's a matter of history.
The genitals
and the eyes.
Yeah.
So the eyes would have been pierced and blinded, and I've established that in a number of...
Messiah's mom.
Well, that's right. Glenis and I both came to this conclusion. But also the genitals would have been lacerated into nothing. This is what people don't... They've got a sanitised
view. Well, no wonder we're not going to be...
I'm sure that's why... I'm sure that's why Miriam Magdalene did not recognise him.
Because
she was not expecting to see someone that was whole. And yet the piercings are still there, because that has to be a testimony to those that pierced him.